Okay. Where to begin? So I want to begin by just speaking to addiction in general and what an actual tragedy the current state of our culture and really our world and the epidemic problem that addiction has become. It's actually getting much worse, I find. It's not getting better. For a variety of reasons, which I don't really want to get into. But we live in a very addicted time. And as far as strategies or solutions to overcome addiction, I think we've really failed a lot of people. And that essentially what we've done historically is we punish and we convict and we put addicts in prison. Is the most common thing that occurs. So there's a lot of suffering just in that right there. When I first met Noah Levine, my teacher, was actually at the first ever and only Buddhist Network Recovery Conference in LA. It was maybe in 2009. And I had just started actually working in addiction. I had just moved to Nashville, Tennessee. I moved to Nashville, Tennessee with my wife, who I was married to at the time, and we both had met in recovery and got married, and she relapsed and started using and left and moved out, and it was a very traumatic, painful experience to having had that relationship end and the loss of that as a result of addiction. I was working with teenagers and inpatient in an inpatient treatment program, and was actively involved in the 12 steps. But I found working with teenagers, especially in the current culture, this is maybe 7 or 8 years ago, so I think it's still pretty current, is a lot of the teenagers I was working for was working at a 12-step based program, and the steps and the philosophy of the 12 steps was really not registering well for 16, 17-year-old kids, who many of them were put in addiction treatment as sort of punishment. The parents are like, I can't deal with you anymore. We have a good insurance. You're going to treatment. You know, so some of these kids were definitely didn't identify as addicts or alcoholics, and their only consequence actually was treatment thus far. And so I was really trying to find another way to go about it, and Noah at this conference was the first time he actually introduced Refuge Recovery as a Buddhist program for recovering from addiction. And I'm sure, as many of you know, and for the last 10 or 12 years, there's been this very big conversation around Buddhism in the 12 steps. There's been several books written about it. And there's this sort of emergence of these two worlds, and that there's actually quite a lot of similarities between the two. Some fairly profound differences between the two. But the question was, and I think Noah was struggling with the question, was could people just use Buddhism? Could we use Dharma as a treatment program to recover from all forms of addiction? Would that actually work? And so, to some degree, I feel it was an experiment, and it's, to some degree, still an experiment that we're in the midst of right now, 7 years later. And so, what is this word addiction? What is addiction? We don't really know what it is. Of course, you could ask many different people and get many different. Some people say it's genetic, some people say it's trauma, some people say it's environmental. We don't really actually, nobody really knows what it is. We know how it manifests. We know that it's a problem. To me, what seems to be the more important question is not so much what it is, but how does it operate? How does it work? So not so much addiction as a noun, but addiction really as a verb, as a thing, as a process, as a sort of a hijack of one's system. And Buddhism, of course, offers a really great analysis of that and a structure and a framework for how that operates and strategies that you can do to, that you can develop to overcome that through meditative training, through ethical living, through wise understanding. The system that we probably know as the Eightfold Path is a great system for living life. It's also a great system for overcoming addiction. And so we define the word as addiction is any behavior strategy that we engage in an attempt to avoid, change, or control seemingly unbearable conditions of the present moment. And so we find ourselves often in life in some situation, some context, some set of conditions where we have deemed it unbearable. I can't do this. Too much. Too much emotion, too much mind, too much pain, too much something. And now I engage in a strategy or a behavior to avoid that. I need to avoid this. I need to change this, or I need to control this. And if I can't avoid or change it, you better believe I'm going to control it. And that system or that habit, the psychological and behavioral way that that plays out, puts us in this very interesting game of what really feels to me like Russian roulette, where what we're doing is we're choosing immediate gratification, or we're choosing temporary relief from the unbearable condition, knowing that there's going to be long-term consequences. There's going to be long-term harm. Everybody pretty much knows that drugs are bad. Nancy Reagan's campaign and to just say no in the 80s didn't pan out for anybody. The DARE program, I used to wear my DARE t-shirt as I was doing drugs. And a lot of people did that. The DARE t-shirt became sort of a punk rock, let's do drugs and wear our DARE t-shirts. That's what I did. So we know this. It's not like we don't have the information. There's plenty of information about addiction and the effects of drugs and alcohol on the body, and we know that it's destructive. But somehow people aren't able to stop. The information isn't really that helpful, it turns out. And so there's this deep, deep sense of there's something happening below conscious choice. There's something happening below logic and reason and being smart and intelligent, that there's something going on in our nervous system, in our emotional system, that we just cannot tolerate. And so when we use the Four Noble Truths in the way that we have used the Four Noble Truths as a way to give a psychological and to some degree existential framework for how addiction plays out, is that addiction creates suffering. Three words. Addiction creates suffering. Intellectually, not that difficult of a concept to grasp. And one of the things that's currently happening that I like is the work of Gabor Mate. Some of you probably are familiar with Gabor Mate, who doesn't really talk so much about what's wrong with addiction, because we know all the problems that are created as a result of addiction, but what is right with the addiction? Well, it gives me temporary relief. It helps regulate my nervous system. It helps me feel connected to other people. It gives my life meaning and purpose. What's wrong with any of those things? Nothing. So addiction is a strategy to avoid, change, or control the underlying pain of our lives that we can't deal with. We can't bear it. We can't tolerate it. Probably much of it has nothing to do with anything that we did. It's not your fault. Somebody installed that pain. And again, this is one of the huge problematic nature of addiction in the culture, is it's this total stigma around shame and guilt, and I'm a bad person, and addiction and addicts are bad people who make bad choices, who should know better. And that feeds into this whole stigma around the shame that comes from it. And really, from a Buddhist perspective, addiction just makes a lot of sense to me. When I first started working with a trauma therapist and she did my assessment, she's like, you have like a 97% chance of being a drug addict when you're a teenager based on your childhood experience and all of the data. There's no reason to feel guilty or ashamed about any of that. And so we start to look at, well, what's the underlying pain? And maybe in the Buddhist context, we would call that dukkha. Some of you know this word dukkha that the Buddha spoke about, that there's dukkha in life. Suffering exists. You're all going to get a little bit on you. Some of us get more than our fair share. Some of us manage it better than others. But at some point, that pain was installed. Now, we have the obvious physical pain, the pain of the body. And ironically, when you look at the pain of the body, I've worked in addiction treatment for a long time, and I've noticed so many people get strung out on drugs and alcohol because they got hurt at work. You know, the guy fell off the ladder and hurt his back, and he got OxyContin from the doctor. The doctor is the new dope man. You don't even have to score drugs on the street anymore. You just go to the doctor. It's a whole other set of issues. So the physical pain, the mental pain, and to some degree, when you think about mental pain, and that's kind of a strange word, right? Mental pain. But the pain of the mind, the pain of anxiety, the pain of worrying, the pain of just thinking too much about everything all the time. My mind, I just want to shut it down. A six-pack and a Valium will shut it down. The pain of the mind, too much thinking. And we've really also culturally, again, we've declared a war on unpleasant emotions and mind states. The pharmacology business isn't the multi-billion-dollar business that it has become. Has arisen because if you're feeling sad or angry, disappointed, fearful, that there's something like wrong with you and you should take some pills or you should. So we've declared a war on emotional states that are unpleasant to some degree. So we've completely lost touch with our humanity on some level. And so we have emotional pain. And this is, I think, the third kind of pain. The emotional pain is probably the one that most of us really, really struggle with. And people with addiction really get trapped and stuck into trying to medicate that. So really, to me, addiction is just self-medication. I can't handle this. Too much pain. I'm going to do something that will temporarily relieve me from that pain. Probably to some degree knowing that it's going to be bad later, but I'll take the relief now. And then the fourth kind of pain that I think about, I think that's also very huge and is starting to come a little bit more into the spotlight, is what I call relational pain. The pain that I've experienced as a result of other human beings. Right back to my primary caregivers, the pain of parents, the pain of my sister getting killed. Relationships, intimate relationships. Anybody have ever experienced relational pain in association with another human being? You're not going to get, unless you're going to put on the brown robes, you're probably not going to get out of the world without some relational pain. And we have no strategy for this. We have no system. We have, no one taught me that in school. No one ever sat down with me in school and said, you know, from time to time, you're going to experience some anger and some fear and some sadness, and here's some strategies that you can develop to how to manage that. So I just wanted to say that as a sense of just to kind of get us into the landscape of what it is that we're talking about. And really, what a really uphill battle I think that we have. And so the second truth, so we talk about addiction creates suffering, the cause, or I would say the installation to some degree, is this repetitive craving. This other word that we get, so in the First Noble Truth, the Buddha talks about dukkha, dissatisfaction, pain, stress. In the Second Noble Truth, he talks about tanha, which translates as something like unquenchable thirst. Ring a bell? A sense of insatiableness. Unquenchable thirst. Hungry ghost. A longing, a craving that cannot be quenched or satisfied. Therefore, it's repetitive. Because it keeps going. And I forget who said it, but I think it was Carl Jung who said this. He said, you can never get enough of something that almost works. And to me, that's really how addiction plays out. I can't get enough of it because it almost works. And it always almost works. And it's going to be different next time. If I could just get the right combination of Jack Daniels, Budweiser, and cocaine, if I could just get the right chemistry, then I would be good. And all humans experience this, right? This isn't just addicts. Addiction has taken on so many new forms, in the forms of there's eating disorder programs opening all over the country, sex addiction, porn addiction. That our system is hardwired to avoid pain on such a level that we have different types of strategies that we all develop. Some of us use drugs, some of us use alcohol, some of us use gambling, some people use sex, some people use shopping. The modern world has got all kinds of really great delivery systems for addiction. It's a smorgasbord of addictive behaviors available to you all. And so to me, it's really, the stigma of it is really a big problematic aspect of it, because it's really, to me, makes a lot of sense. That if I have overwhelming sense of pain and discomfort and pain in my life and confusion and fear and anger and sadness and all of these emotions that just seem yucky and unbearable and too much, and if I can do something to make that go away, even for a little while, you best believe I'm going to be doing that for a minute until the pain of that becomes too much. And then we find ourselves sitting in rooms like this because that didn't work. And then this third noble truth, that recovery is possible. You can end the suffering of addiction. And you can end the suffering of addiction by engaging in the Eightfold Path. So really, if we look at it from a treatment planning perspective, from a clinical perspective, the Four Noble Truths is like the best treatment plan ever written. Here's the problem. Here's the cause. Here's the solution. Here's the medicine. Boom. 2,600-year-old tradition to overcome all types of addiction. And of course, the word that we use in Buddhism that causes suffering is craving, clinging, attachment. Addiction? Same thing? I think so. And so there's this potential we all have, and so we talk about taking refuge, and that's why we call refuge recovery is because what we're trying to do here is to come to terms with, to some degree, everything I just said, so that we have some sort of philosophical framework for what it is that has happened to us, what's my experience been. And we have inventory processes in refuge recovery where we look at these things, we look at the underlying pain, we look at all the suffering that my addiction has caused me in a very real way, in a very honest way, in a very cards on the table, no shame, this is what happened. And this is such a huge part of mindfulness, is the word inventory, which to me I don't register with so strongly, but to me it's an investigation. I investigate the causes and the conditions of my addiction. Like a CSI crime investigation, all the files out on the table. We start to normalize it and start to the practice of forgiveness. If I normalize this and I understand it from this framework, I'm not trying to blame anymore. I'm not trying to point the finger at who gave me the addiction. Did I get it? Whose fault is it? I'm a bad person. I make bad choices because of all the stuff that happened. And we get caught in this sort of victim mentality, which doesn't help. We just sort of come to terms and to be honest about that. And so when we take refuge in this idea, we take refuge in traditional Buddhism, and really all Buddhist traditions talk about taking refuge, is we take refuge in the Buddha, not in the Buddha, but in our ability to wake up. Buddha just means to be awake. Buddhism you could translate as wake-up-ism. Wake up. Wake up to the suffering that addiction has created. Wake up to the causes. Wake up to the solution. Wake up to the path. Wake up to all of it. Take refuge in that. Refuge means something like safety. We take refuge. We find a verifiable source. To me, refuge means trustworthy. What's trustworthy? What's safe? What's reliable? Where can I dwell? Where can I place my heart that's safe? That's refuge. And so again, this is where probably Buddhism really is diametrically opposed to the 12 steps, and really to most religion. If you put all the world's religion on a stage, Buddhism is a very awkward character on that stage. Because it's kind of like, yeah, I don't really agree with any of you guys. I kind of got my own thing going on over here. And that is that as human beings, we have the potential, we have the capacity, we have everything that we need in this fathom-long body to liberate ourselves from the causes of suffering. Possible. Potential. Take refuge in that. Trust that idea. No higher power, no God. Internal refuge. But that's not quite enough, so we have two more. We take refuge in that idea, which is very empowering, I find. It's not that I'm powerless, I'm empowered. It's my life and I'm going to change it. I'm willing to look at my pain now. I'm willing to look at my trauma. I'm willing to sit in the fire of the present moment, no matter how hard it is. I will not check out into my addiction. And so we have this Dharma. We take refuge in the Dharma, which oftentimes is just the teachings of the Buddha. But the Dharma is the truth of the way it is, the truth of what I've just said. And to check it out for yourself. All of these teachings and everything that I offer and everything that I've learned from Buddhism is said to be ahipassako, which is a Pali term. That means come and see for yourself. Come check it out. Don't believe me. Come to a verifiable place where you know for yourself that it's true. And this Dharma, the way things are, the way things happen, we take refuge in these practices and saying, actually, if I am going to wake up to the mind, if I'm going to wake up, I need to train myself in mindfulness. I need to train myself in wisdom and compassion. I need to train. I need to learn how to meet pain with compassion and forgiveness. I have to train myself how to do that because I don't know how to do that. I hate pain and confusion and fear and anger and sadness. I want to avoid change and control those things. If I could get rid of sadness, just drive me to the clinic right now. Let's get it done. Get it out of here. I hate it. Empathy. Cooperation. We have to learn how to cooperate with our emotional system. And again, it's so hard because we've been so conditioned in this world to that unpleasant emotions are bad and wrong, and if you're feeling them, you must have done something. Maybe you're just a human being who has emotions. Does anybody not have anger, fear, and sadness? Does anybody not know what I mean when I say those words? No, you totally know what I mean. So we have to train ourselves to tolerate and to bear with and to be able to inhabit those experiences so that the unbearable moment becomes a bearable moment. And that's what recovery is being able to inhabit the conditions of the present moment, whether they're painful or pleasant. Tolerate discomfort. I care about my pain. I care about my life. I care about how hard things have been for me. I train myself in compassion and forgiveness and stop blaming everybody. Stop blaming yourself. Blaming doesn't work. It's never worked for me, and I really, really gave that one a fair shake. I'll just pull out my blame thrower and let everybody have it. To the point where I feel existentially betrayed by the universe. If you really want to get out in the skinny branches, I'll be honest with you. The whole universe has betrayed me. I blame everything. I don't believe in God, but I blame him. And we see this. This is a huge psychological habit that we all have. So how do we overcome blaming by practicing forgiveness? That turns out to be quite a useful skill. And usually most of us will find that these don't come naturally to us. We have to train in these types of things. So we take refuge in that. We take refuge in the Dharma. We say that that's trustworthy. Is compassion trustworthy? Is blaming trustworthy? Is hatred trustworthy? Has it worked? Probably not so much. How do I overcome that? To train my heart and mind in these directions. So we take refuge in this Dharma and mindfulness and being aware, paying attention, waking up to what's true. And to me, really, this sense of dukkha or pain and the dissatisfaction, it's really hard for us, I think, because it puts us right in the center of our vulnerability, and we don't like that. We don't like that. You know, and again, the Buddha, in his cleverness, really normalized that. He says, well, the human mind, consciousness, is highly vulnerable to the forces of greed, hatred, and delusion. You might not want to be vulnerable, but you are vulnerable. Like it or not. I hate it. Again, now we're back to that. Now I have to pretend like everything's okay. You ever do that? Just feeling really vulnerable, like you're about ready to cry, and someone goes up to you, hey, how's it going? You're like, oh, good. Totally awesome. So happy with my life right now? No, we don't do that. We fake it. We pretend. We live in this inauthentic. Because again, it's not okay to suffer. It's not okay to be a person. So how do we take refuge in that? And to see, to me, what seems to be the most sense, and one of the reasons why we wanted to create a community for refuge recovery is this third refuge of taking refuge in Sangha or community, and that if you're going to do the first two refuges, you're probably going to need some help. You're probably going to need some people to help you do that. And there's a really interesting book, a book that's really kind of clinically written, if you can get through that kind of language, called Addiction as Attachment Disorder, which points to the John Bowlby stuff around attachment theory. But it basically says, it does an analysis, and it says the reason why, and I don't know if this is true, but I like what it says, is that the reason why 12 steps have been so helpful to people is because of the community. It's not because of the steps. It's not because of the higher power. It's not because of the philosophy. Of course, that might help a little bit. But what the real reason why human beings excel and succeed in the 12 steps is because they can walk into a room of 40 strangers and be vulnerable about how they had such a hard time today, and everybody kind of rallies. That's why. And that's a beautiful thing. That's a rare commodity in this world. It's a very rare commodity in this world to be able to go into any building and be able to tell on your suffering. Because that's really what this is about, is you have to be willing to tell on it. Because what is shame love? Shame loves secrecy, don't tell nobody. Keep your mouth shut, be silent, and judge. Shame will just thrive in that environment. But you go and tell on it, and it loses all its power. Because everybody goes, yeah, me too. And it's like, oh, you too? It's like, yeah. It's like, dude, we all did that. Get over it. It's like, oh, I thought I was the only one who did that. No. The nature of empathy, just like me. And tell on that. And so we felt it was very important to try to create communities, peer-led communities, where people could start refuge recovery meetings anywhere. And we've been so lucky, and I'm so grateful for the 12 steps, because most of the people who have started good refuge recovery meetings are people who have been leading 12-step meetings for years, and they're just kind of good at leading meetings because they've been trained to lead meetings, right? So it's so great that we've been able to incorporate these two. And I'm also a part of the work that I do is I'm the executive director for the Refuge Recovery nonprofit. So I get like a lot of emails from people all over the world and all over the country, which I'm mostly happy to get, but it's just a lot of work because I don't like to spend as much time on the computer as I actually do. But we are very 12-step friendly. We sometimes get some criticism on that, but it's not the case. Very 12-step friendly, and people come to Refuge Recovery who do 12 steps, who don't. It's like, we don't really care. You're totally welcome at a refuge meeting, regardless of anything, and that trying to hold that spirit of inclusion. And so we really need to take refuge in the Sangha, and that this is really something, because addiction is so strong and so rampant, that people really need support. And I actually believe what I learned in early 12-step recovery was that the person with who's been clean for a week can help the person who's been clean for one day. And that you don't need to be an empowered Buddhist teacher, and that you don't, you know, because there's not enough of us out there, and that we really felt like this could be a peer-led thing. And you're so lucky here in Seattle, right, to have a Seattle Insight. And there's not a lot of Insight meditation centers in the country. There's like really a handful of them. And I meet people all the time who are like in different parts of the country who are like, we don't have a place, we don't have a community, we don't have anywhere to go meditate, we don't have anywhere to learn meditation. And so I think sometimes we can take it for granted. I'll go next week. Right? That we have this, you know, and I'm very happy to see this many people here. I didn't know it was such a big interest in this type of stuff. So again, this is this idea of a refuge, is where is a trustworthy way in which I can pay attention. And so even in mindfulness, when you look at mindfulness practices, which is really a huge component of refuge recovery, it's a huge, you know, the Buddha didn't say it lightly. He said, this is the direct path to liberation, is what he called the Satipatthana, mindfulness practice, the direct path to how you end suffering. Is you turn yourself towards the mind and you come face to face with the mind and you come to understand the mind. And so meditation is really a huge component of what we're trying to establish and trying to train. So to some degree we could say, from a Buddhist psychology perspective, is to some degree I'm taking refuge in something in every single moment. Because what do we need more than anything else as human beings is safety. And if I don't feel safe, I'll do some strange things. Most of my life, truth be told, I really, safety has not been a very common ally. I felt very unsafe most of my life. Probably until very recently, in the last 5 years. I remember talking to a therapist one time, and she asked me something about, you know, when do you feel safe or how do you feel safe? And I was like, safety? I was like, what is this word you speak of? I'm like, I don't feel safe. I'm hyper-vigilant. I'm looking around the room all the time. Is something bad going to happen? When is it going to happen? Is it going to happen now? Who's going to do it to me? It's just like highly traumatized psychological experience of hypervigilance. And so I took safety in substances. I took safety in drugs. I took safety in alcohol. I took safety in all of the behaviors that come with that. I got sober. I took refuge in relationships, sexual relationships, in workaholism. Took refuge in money. If I just get enough of money, I just got to get the right house in the right neighborhood, I'll take refuge in that. We're always taking refuge, most of the time, in some external experience. We seek safety and comfort in different aspects of what's happening out there. And when I just meet the right person, or when I just have the right job, and when I just finish this degree, or when I get rid of this job, or I get rid of this relationship. I'm always taking refuge in ideas and concepts, and I'm taking refuge in a place, in a destination that's other than what's happening right now. And I cut myself off from that. I cut off from the life that I have, and I live and I take refuge in the hope that my life could be some other way. And if only, then I would be happy, I would be safe, I would be okay. So we have this big overview of the way that we can train in the philosophy of refuge or the Buddha's Dharma and these practices, and then just in this view of watch your mind as you go through life, as you go through the day, watch your mind where you're feeling unsafe or you're feeling disturbed or you're feeling an unbearable moment or you're feeling lonely or you're feeling something that's undesirable, that's unwanted, and the mind will try to go where can the mind wants to go somewhere that would be other than this, that would be better than this, and we cut off. We suffer. Psychologically, for me, the second noble truth, suffering is created in the constant idea that if only X, then Y. If only this were true, then I would be okay. And you can fill in those variables as many ways as you like, and I'm sure that you do. And so really, to some degree, how do we come to terms with the issue at hand? How do we come to terms with the life that we're actually currently experiencing? Because that's doable. You can do that. And the Buddha says so many times, he said, if it wasn't possible, if I didn't believe and didn't know that it was possible, I wouldn't ask you to do any of it. And so this constant intention that we put on mindfulness and this very important aspect of trying to establish a daily practice for yourself. So constantly be training the mind to go to refuge groups or come to Seattle Insight or participate in a meditative community. Practice daily. Even when you don't want to, which probably will be most of the time. And just training the mind over and over and over again. So that we're learning. We actually have to learn how to come back. To be present I have found it to be a skill that I've had to develop. And so to me, even Buddhism, Dharma, refuge, it's a verb, it's something that we do, it's a behavior. Buddhism is a behavior. It's not a dogma. It's not something you either agree with or don't agree with. Of course, that's part of it. But it's something that you do and you experience and you go, oh gee, that's pretty good. I think I should do more of that. It's an experiential type of thing. And the more we do it, the more we incline, we start to reap these little fruits and we say, oh, forgiveness is more valuable and more helpful than blaming. Paying attention to what's happening right now is more valuable and more important than checking out into my hopes and fears and how much better things could be if only. And we just do that, practice that way. So addiction's not really such a big deal after all, maybe. If we can get over all the blaming and the shaming and the stigmas, we can see that it's just part of the human experience. It's the way that we are trying to decrease and avoid the pain and trying to increase and enhance the pleasant experiences. And this is a hardwired biological system. It's completely not your fault. And it's a highly overcomable. You can overcome these things. So I think that's all I want to say about refuge tonight. And I would like to, we have some time left, I really would like to hear some questions that you might have. I'm sure you might have many, but I'll do my best to answer them. So let's take some Q&A. So thank you. Right here in the front. I mean, I know off the top of my head a handful of people in our program, and I have friends and colleagues who, you know, I think it's, I think actually, to be honest with you, every program works. It's just getting people to do it. CBT works, DBT works, 12 steps work. It all works. It's, you know, how do you get the person willing to stick with it long enough? But I find that, especially with the popularity, A, of mindfulness, and the practice-based aspects of that, that I feel very confident, and we have a treatment center in Los Angeles that we just teach refuge recovery, and it really works for people. But it's hard. It's not an easy. This is not easy, you know. But I think that what it offers and promises is worth the endeavor. Yeah. Yes, please. Yeah.
And I also practice Buddhism as well. And it just was kind of provocative and intriguing to me. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah.
Like, how do you do recovery with no higher power?
Sure.
God? And I even think of, like, there's a higher power of mindfulness.
Sure.
I think about talks about the higher power of
awareness.
But is it, to me, it's not like, is it an atheist or a non-theist?
I believe that Buddhism is an atheistic, and I think most people would probably make that claim. But then again, a little bit, we're talking about semantics. So, which is kind of a, you know, not a helpful strategy to sort of negotiate, because we're talking about words and concepts now, which are limited. Exactly. So, you know, God, you know, when the Buddha was asked about God, he mostly wouldn't answer the question. And so higher power is probably more a word that we, you could say, is mindfulness a higher power? Sure, why not? Is loving kindness or compassion, are they higher powers? Are they part of the power greater than ourselves? One could say yes, one could say no. I think it's just a matter of, we have to wear the t-shirt that fits the best for us. So trying to come to terms with that in your own way, to me it's a little bit of a moot point on some level, because whether it works or not, what's more important, whether you call it, is sort of. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of different ways people come to terms with that. And that's also been true in 12 steps, is we have to come to terms with some of these things. But one thing that I've noticed, and the reason I say that, is that the people that I've worked with who struggle a lot are people who actually really struggled with these concepts. And they come into refuge like, oh my God, I don't have to worry about God or higher power, I can just start meditating. And so I've noticed that that's been an obstacle for a lot of people. But it's also not been an obstacle for some people. So it's just a matter of kind of ahipasaka, right? Come and see for yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. Can I say one more thing?
Please.
Yeah, it's been a huge obstacle for me, and I'm really excited about the Buddhist recovery movement and what you guys are doing. It's amazing what's happening, this movement. It's really exciting.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you. And what's your name? Ben? Yes?
So, it's more of a comment, but I'm just kind of curious about your thoughts. So, I've done 12 step recovery, and that's why I recommend. I've been doing refuge recovery. I was introduced to a book on 12 steps in the Buddha from somebody in my old 12 step program. And one of the things, and I'm really happy that refuge is there, because there are people that have that resistance to the higher power or whatever. But what I've sort of observed in doing other types of therapy and process groups is that the work of recovery is the work of recovery, and that 12-step recovery is a methodology, and Buddhism provides a methodology, and DBT provides a methodology. But ultimately, the resistance, and, you know, that I find, it's the same resistance. Like, I go to 12-step recovery, I don't like the higher power, so finding something to not like.
Right.
Because the resistance is to doing the work, and the work is introspection, investigation, inventory, cleaning up your side of the street, making some sort of amends. I mean, you know, and that's the thing that I that's something that I've seen is I, you know, and I haven't jumped from program to program because I think they all work. I love that you comment on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think you're right. And this is it. If you don't want to do it, you don't want to do it. You can call it whatever you want to call it. It's like, if you know, and that's the problematic nature of addiction, is it's just that, like, not wanting. But again, when we use refuge, again, we're asking you to, A, don't take my word for it, and to investigate for yourself. And I find that it kind of, Buddhism to some degree is disarming in that way. And that a lot of times the framework and the structure of it is so simplistic in the Four Truths that usually people are less suspicious. There's not so much magic or elusive, esoteric stuff. It's just kind of like, yeah, try meditation, try this. That it doesn't always happen, but I find that there's a part of it that's disarming for a lot of people, where people need to let their guard down. And of course, people with addiction, they don't trust, they have trust issues, and they're very suspicious. And so, you know, we have to be kind and friendly about the reality of that. Yeah. Yes, please.
So what they came up with was that basically to do God's will, you would have to do good things, and not doing God's will would be bad things.
Right.
Those are ethical constructs. And that's the thing, that's what's so appealing about Buddhism, that Buddhism actually, being a person that was pretty much raised in 12-step programs, that Buddhism teaches us how to practice the second, third, and 11th step.
Sure.
Which are not really... When you look at the book, when you look at the big book, we're not really given clear instructions. How do you let go? How do you do God's will?
Sure.
How do you meditate? No one teaches us.
That's right.
But Buddhism teaches us.
Yeah.
They work together fairly well.
Yeah, Buddhism is a pretty organized system, almost to a fault. You know, I think we were list worshippers, right? When you start studying Buddhism, it's like there's all these lists. But it's a pretty organized system, and of course there is an ethical framework that's pretty clearly outlined in the five precepts and stuff. So it's giving us lots of guidance. It's really giving us what I feel is a pretty detailed map, you know, that we can kind of follow and find our way along, whether you're on day one or it doesn't matter where you are. It's giving us something that's not so elusive. So I appreciate the comments. Yes? Hi, Amelia. Yeah, karma is such a tricky word because it's defined in so many different ways by so many different traditions. And also, you know, from what I know, the Buddha was very clear about, like, if you try to figure out your karma, you're just going to go crazy. Because you can't decipher. Because I might be like, well, look at all the stuff that happened in my life. I must be either a bad person or I did something bad. And it can get in a previous life and it can get really out there. So the way that karma makes the most sense to me is usually the way that it's really translated, especially in the Theravada, is karma is intention. And so basically what I want to do is look at my karma kind of from this moment moving forward and drop the trying to figure out how I got all the bad karma, but inclining the mind in awareness, inclining the mind in compassion, and forgiveness, and all these ethical and wise factors, I want to incline my mind forward. And so I basically want to try to transform my karma or create new karma in a way that I can, to some degree, track. And so getting caught up in the past and trying to figure out or come to terms with the karma that got you standing in right here tonight, I think is a dangerous game. Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm not necessarily saying that thinking of my karma is bad.
Yeah. I think you're lucky that you hold that view. And I totally respect that, but I think that's a rare. You're probably in a low percentile, where I think a lot of times the tendency with this trauma and addiction is that karma, we sometimes can use that as a sort of blaming, like, you know, we all have different relationships to the concept of karma. I don't teach karma so much or talk about it a lot because it's so elusive of a concept, but more in the sense of you're using your story in a way to incline yourself into a new life or to a new experience. So to some degree, I would say you're probably doing a really great job of transforming your karma for the better because you're holding it in a view and an attention that is wholesome and moving forward. So, you know, but I think that you're probably in a lower percentile and that more people, when they try to figure that stuff out, it can get really, it can become quite destructive sometimes. Yeah. Yes, please, right here.
Hi, Karen. And I'm a novice, so forgive me if this is obvious answer, and then it was for me. But with Refuge Recovery, is there an equivalent to having a sponsor in that program?
Yep, that's a million-dollar question. We're actually writing a pamphlet on that right now. Yes, we would like to have mentors and these types of things, but because the program is so new, I probably could answer that question in like 5 years or 10 years, like with some degree of accuracy. I'm mostly curious. But, you know, again, I believe that the person, again, with the person who's got 2 months can help the person with 1 month. So I think that part of it is trying to create what we call Kalyana Mita, like some friendship and that stuff where it's not going to necessarily be someone's going to take you through, but I think the culture of Refuge Recovery, the question is, will Refuge Recovery even be around in 10 years? I don't even know. I mean, I really am curious. Or will it just be another thing that doesn't, you know, who knows? But I think that that's something that the culture and the community will shape and define organically, karmically, if you will, and that I don't actually know. But, you know, I think that people can help each other in a way, but we don't have a clear outlined system for that yet. And it's a question that I get in my inbox every day. Yeah. So I'm going to take one more question here in the back. Yeah. You know, that's a huge point of it. That's something that I really didn't give much voice to that's so important is this renunciation. You know, which to me, renunciation is giving up that which is extra or not needing anything extra, where it's to some degree dealing with the craving or the dissatisfaction, or a lot of times when I'm reaching for the cookie or the drink, it's that there's something happening that I'm trying to avoid. And, you know, that's hard to negotiate that, but it's part of it is understanding very clearly the behaviors in which we know lead to long-term consequences. And in the moment, if we're aware of the fact that there's actually a choice, we just have to choose to not do that. And that's easier said than done in some scenarios, but that's really the renunciation that we're looking for, saying, I'm no longer going to engage in this behavior. I know it's going to make me feel good for like a minute or however long it is, but I know in my experience, from my inventory, where this goes, and I'm actually not going to do this right now. And dealing with the challenge and the discomfort of having to negotiate that, but standing up for yourself in a really a fierce compassion of like, you know what, I just don't do this anymore. It's just over. You know, and sometimes we fail, and that's sometimes part of the process too, is an opportunity to look back and to have some forgiveness and not to blame again, but to just really, when the awareness is there and we know we're about to do something that we actually don't want to do, we really have to follow through and not do that. So it's really kind of taking that stand out of compassion and care for yourself. Not out of a, like, these are the rules, but like, I know where this goes. This isn't skillful for me to do this. So I'm going to hang around for a little while if you have any more questions, because I could talk to you guys all night and I'd like to end on time. And I believe you might have some announcements for everybody. Yeah.